Then there was a table, an Excel table, that detailed what the current provision is, what it would look like with the amendment, and then there was a summarized Word document just sitting out in brief what each of the amendments are overall to summarize. And then I'll just take you through the presentation now, which you also have the PowerPoint presentation. So in essence, there's four documents, but I shouldn't keep you long. I may say the booklet that we've handed out to you is in six different languages at the moment, but it's a client's version of the legal aid guide, and it's not an instruction to the committee as to whether they cross-examine me or not.
We appreciate that.
So it's there for clients to understand what's available in plain language, and so that we can distribute them. And we've printed quite a number of them, and we have set aside to be able to make available to Parliament, to the portfolio committees, and to Parliament a substantial number of those guides if they so require them. So then I'll move on. The overview of the presentation, you'll listen, see, I just deal with our mandate, why the requirement for the guide and the ratification, and then specifically you'll see there's six broad categories in which we seek amendments to the guide, and then just simple concluding comments. If we go on, we all know in terms of Legal Aid SA mandate, specifically section 35.2 and 35.3, where our mandate is specifically set out, explicitly set out in terms of detained and accused persons' rights to legal representation, section 28.1H, as we all know, in regard to civil legal aid for children, and then obviously in terms of our own act, where it says what our objectives are is to make or render or make available legal aid to indigent persons that provide legal representation at state expenses contemplated in the Constitution. And then obviously there are various other pieces of legislation which I haven't detailed. I don't think it's really necessary for our intents and purposes to detail that. The last time we were before the committee would have been in around about September 2011, because the National Assembly ratified the current version of the Legal Aid Guide in September 2011 and the National Council of Provinces on the 24th of November 2011, and we have to bring it into operation within 3 months of that final ratification, which was then we brought it in on the 23rd of February 2012, having been fully printed. I then deal with the section that requires, as you know, the Legal Aid Act doesn't state how the objectives of legal aid should be attained. So it doesn't set out what kind of matters legal aid is available in. It doesn't set out any means tests. So it doesn't set out how we should do and how legal aid should be rendered. But what it does provide is that such a document called the Legal Aid Guide should set out the policies and procedures in terms of which legal aid can be made available. So the document is really there to set out clearly and transparently for what legal aid is available in terms of the types of matters, as to who can qualify, what the procedures and requirements are to qualify, and how you should go about it. So that's the broad purpose of the Legal Aid Guide. Then Section 3, capital A2, says that the guide, and unfortunately we still got our old act from 1969, there is a bill that I know we know Cabinet has already approved, where we will obviously be able to deal with it, but it says that the National Assembly and Senate, which we now read as the National Council of Provinces, should ratify the document. And therefore, what I will do is then just look broadly at what those amendments are. If we can go to the next slide, you'll see, in terms of criminal cases, the last time we appeared before the committee, one of the issues were we didn't specifically detail under representation for children in conflict with the law, make a specific provision having regard to the Child Justice Act. We amended that undertaking by the chairperson at the time to the committee that we would implement that immediately by circular, which we then did do, and we did send a copy. We have now obviously incorporated those amendments, and specifically also where children are appearing, we exclude certain cases, or we don't list certain cases in the district court where we would render assistance, minor offences, traffic offences, those kind of things. But what we say is no child may be refused legal aid, even if those matters are not listed in terms of the legal aid guide for the district court. Also, we extended it in terms of preliminary inquiries, as it's regarded as the first appearance in court. And then specifically amendment in terms of where a duty care practitioner represented and finalised an accused in a matter, and the accused initially elected not to appeal, but subsequently then comes back to us. We've put in a provision that that matter should go back to the same practitioner to be able to deal with the appeal, because they would have been, well, leave to appeal, because they would be in a better position to deal with that. Chair, then broadly in terms of civil matters, we placed a limitation on previously in terms of the number of civil matters for whom someone can, or how many cases a person can qualify, to limit it to one, unless there was a, as a result of various applicants being involved in many cases, sometimes abusing the system and excluding others from the system. So we limited their ability, save now that we've built in a discretion for the regional operations executive to approve additional matters, subject that on a balance of probabilities they're satisfied of the prospects of success, and that they can justify, or the benefit to the client can justify the cost that we would have to incur. This coming to the issue of maintenance matters, and I should maybe just clarify it, what we did bring in July after the board meeting in May, on in 1st of July, there was a concern that in domestic violence matters that the elderly were not being assisted and were in court, specifically in circumstances where they were very vulnerable, and the board then approved at that stage that we make legal aid available to elderly persons as defined in the Elderly Persons Act, although we brought the age down to 60 and not 65, specifically in circumstances where they were before and were in the domestic violence court, because we were of particular vulnerability. What we have now done in terms of maintenance cases, as a result of there being at least 250,000 maintenance cases a year, resources just don't permit us to provide legal representation in all those cases. What we do say currently is we can provide advice firstly, and secondly, if the other party is legally represented and there's merit in your case, we can then assist you with legal representation. What we're proposing now is to take that a bit further, that we can provide legal representation in maintenance matters where there's a failure of the system, enabling the applicant to seek or execute an order and it's taken longer than 12 months. Or if there's an abuse of the system by the other party, which makes it difficult to obtaining the granting or the execution of an order, you find very often people play hide and seek. And I think we've seen that in the Constitutional Court judgment, specifically where they say some people can make use of the system and abuse. So that's where we've decided that we would open it up in a limited manner to provide for persons that are struggling then obviously to either obtain or enforce a maintenance order. And then in the administration of estates, we've clarified it a bit more. So we're limiting the instance where the estate does not exceed the amount determined by the minister in terms of Section 18.3 of the Administration of Estates Act, which is currently 125,000 rand. But we have a rider there that if there is an immovable property involved, it can exceed that amount, but as long as that immovable property is not valued at greater than 500,000 rand. So that, and that you'll see will align specifically in terms of the assets limits we've put in terms of our means test generally. So this is just to clarify where we would assist. And that's specific in maintenance matters. And that only links to where there are children involved in the estates. If we move on, our guide where we look at civil matters, we're only entitled to give legal aid in cases where we are satisfied that there are merits and that the case will be successful on a balance of probabilities. We found, though, that in certain cases, merit reports aren't really relevant, and where we should rather then limit and exclude the requirement to then provide merit reports in those cases. You'll see we've listed them there in terms of simple divorces, undefended divorces, eviction cases where we're assisting to negotiate client additional time within the property before moving out, domestic violence cases to protect the interests of children, and then of course in the administration of estates. one thing that was mentioned earlier was we did a project to test whether we could render services via mediation services, and in that case we brought on board both Judicare practitioners and our own practitioners who were trained in mediation, rendering mediation services and acting as mediators, but we found there were instances where our practitioners were involved that they couldn't then be involved in the mediation, and therefore that we had to bring in other practitioners to be able to be involved in the mediation. And that's why there was previously a restriction on Judicare practitioners being able to do that, and that's really just to remove the restriction so that we can look at this whole issue of mediation and making it more readily available in resolving disputes. Commissions of Inquiry, I think we've discussed that quite a bit this morning. So the first bullet really just says is where we are mandated and funded by the establishing authority in commissions. And then we can provide legal representation for witnesses or persons before appearing before a commission where the commissions have certified that they are standing before the commission. That's our proposal in terms of the legal aid guide. We've retained a discretion specifically in some instances, once again, to be able to allocate subject to availability of resources and in exceptional circumstances assistance where that funding is not made available, and we've listed the criteria as to which should then be considered. If we had a look and consider and there was no funding made available, as to when we could then exercise the discretion to make it available. I don't intend taking it through. This was obviously prepared prior to the judgment that was delivered on Monday, but that's our proposal in how we would deal with commissions. It's very difficult to be able to deal with a mandate which you won't know whether it's going to happen or not happen, and therefore it makes more sense for the funding to be made available at the time of the establishment and by the establishing authority than just to generally make an amount available. Then if we can just miscellaneous issues, specifically section 204 witnesses, these are witnesses that normally the state use them as witnesses, and they would be able to get an exemption from prosecution or a stay of prosecution on the basis that they give full and truthful evidence. What we were finding is we didn't provide for it in our guide, but courts would require it because what they feel is they would want to be addressed at the end of the case once the witness had given evidence as to whether that witness should qualify for the 204 exemption. And it's really for that we say we should assist so that the court can be addressed as to whether that exemption should be granted or not. And then as to extradition proceedings, also an issue that wasn't specifically dealt with in terms of the legal aid guide, we feel that persons that are facing extradition may face substantial injustice if unrepresented, specifically if they've got to convince the court and place evidence before the court that the alleged charge does not warrant a prosecution in a foreign court. And there we've said if we make use of Judicare practitioners and not our own, that our normal tariffs in terms of the civil tariffs will apply, because the court dealing with extradition proceedings is a court sui generis. It's not a criminal court, it's not a civil court. It's got a very specific role and jurisdiction, and it's not fulfilling a function as a criminal court or a civil court. Then, specifically then the second last issue is supply chain management policy issues, which arose as a result of last year we presented to you in terms of the tax clearance certificates. And so we re-looked at our procurement policies insofar as it relates to legal services within Legal Aid South Africa, where we procure private practitioners to render services to our clients, specifically in where we use impact litigation and or cooperation agreements, mostly with university law clinics. We've clarified the requirements in terms of the Treasury regulations as to what they should comply with in submitting proposals to us, because you find in impact litigation there will be specific firms or legal NGOs that will say, we have this matter where this is the issue we want to litigate and we have these clients, would you be prepared to fund? So in terms of compliance with national treasury regulations, we've just changed the policy to ensure as to the requirements that any organization or firm that want to submit on behalf of a client, what they would have to comply with if we are to appoint them to render those services. And specifically then the tax clearance certificate. Then that will deal with the, under the supply chain management, there's the second part in terms of our duty care practitioners, and that will be the next slide, where we have also, once again, we had our own system in terms of how we would do the allocation of duty care matters. And it was an automated system that would look at the BBBE requirements. We had a scoring for the firms and the practitioners where we gave them a specific BEE score. We also then looked at not the numbers of cases they had, but in terms of what fees they've been paid over a period of time to ensure that we get an even spread of the fee income based on black economic empowerment. And the system would automatically calculate and update as soon as we paid another account. The system would calculate it and would then rank the practitioners. And if there's a new instruction to be allocated, we would then issue it to practitioners listed first, second, third, and fourth. If the first practitioner accepts it via SMS, and it's offered via SMS, the system would then automatically then allow it to allocate it, or it would wait 24 hours to see if the first practitioner listed didn't respond, whether the second, third, or fourth practitioner then responded before it went and allocated it. We have an audit system that then enables us, if there's any deviation from it, to then tell us the reasons for the deviation. The only problem that we had there and encountered there was specifically the issue of tax clearance certificates, and so therefore we then aligned the whole supply chain management of that specific element. There was no problem with that, save that we didn't seek tax clearance certificates for practitioners who were then earning more than 30,000 Rand in a year. The problem with that is we don't know how much we're going to pay in a year, and therefore now we require all practitioners in terms of these amendments to then submit tax clearance certificates up front before we accredit them. If they expire, then our system automatically then blocks them being granted any instructions until they've given us an updated tax clearance certificate. So this specifically then, we've aligned this and tightened up our policies in regard to how they would accredit with us and what they have to submit to us in terms of the registration of good standing with the relevant professional body, the tax clearance certificate, or if it's an association of advocates we haven't recognized and not satisfied that they exercise effective disciplinary control, that association would have to then accredit with us first before any of their members would be able to be accredited. And then if they make any misrepresentation in regard to their status in good standing with the relevant body and things, it could lead to them then being removed from our accreditation system. So we've tightened up on those. That's just the supply chain management issue. And then the last 3.5 is then our means test. We've clarified the procedure here, followed by an applicant in a criminal matter to appeal against refusal of legal aid where they have exceeded the means test. What we've got to understand in terms of our means test, the constitutional requirement is the question of whether you're able to afford the cost of your legal representation or not. Our means test is a simple administrative manner that we can deal with 99.9% of the applicants because we're able to determine it. Those that fall outside and exceed the means test, we've really got to apply our minds, are you able to afford the cost of your legal representation or not? That is not left to the Justice Centres or Regions say that they have a limited discretion in terms of the guide of 1,000, exceeding the means test in criminal matters by 1,500 or 3,000 Rand respectively. Anything above that's got to come to a national office committee that will then consider whether you're able to afford the cost or not. And linked to that now, we've also brought in a contribution policy whereby anyone that comes and qualifies exceeds the means test, we'll also require them to make a contribution, though, to their legal costs so that they also have a stake in ensuring that their trial is completed timely, and therefore that we require them then to make, we determine the amount that they must pay, but they then pay it in monthly installments across to us. And we put out the procedures as to how we determine that and how the amounts are determined, as well as how we manage the collection of those monies. And then lastly, in terms of the legal aid tariffs in both criminal and civil matters, we always look at it on an annual basis in terms of inflation. And as of 1 April 2013, we increased it with an average of about 5.3%, both for the criminal and civil tariffs. That's the, in broad, the amendments, Chair, that we've brought and brought to your attention. So really, in conclusion, obviously for us, as I mentioned earlier, the legal aid guide is an essential tool for us to ensure the effective and efficient functioning of Legal Aid South Africa on a sustainable basis. People can then hold us accountable against what we set as the criteria, what we make available, and we're also then able to manage it on a sustainable basis and know what we are required to deliver. And we therefore request the committee, obviously subject to the questions that will come, to recommend the Legal Aid Guide for ratification by the National Assembly in terms of Section 3, Capital Aid 2 of the Legal Aid Act. Thank you, Chair. That's the presentation.
Yeah, thank you. Just one question. Why do you confine the contribution policy only to criminal matters? I mean, my, for example, maintenance. If someone has got a job but they're still backing to get you know, the contribution for maintenance, surely they should also be allowed to contribute what they can while they get assistance for the rest.
Thanks, Chair. It's just something that I mentioned earlier, that affordability. Whether there's no chance of actually looking at that, but it's not open-ended. As part of the enabling regulations.
Mr. Sibanioli. Also, just one question. How does the Legal Aid South Africa compete with a one-man practitioner, one-person practitioner, who has just qualified, admitted as an attorney, wants to start a practice? When a suspect comes to court, the suspect is asked, given his rights, you've got the right of legal representation, do you have your own attorney? Do you want to have a legal aid practitioner, or do you want to defend your own yourself? Now I'm looking at a situation which we are now, where there is also the small claims court, where people can take their own matters to a level of 12,000 rand, the jurisdiction of the small claims court, and look at a one-person practitioner who opens the office, finding himself around this environment of the Legal Aid South Africa, the Small Claims Court now. Are they able to survive, start a practice?
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chief. Yes, on the civil side, we've only at this stage the discretion to be able to grant legal aid if they exceed the means test. The ROEs and the Justice Centre executives do have a discretion. There's also then a broad discretion for myself that there's an appeal against refusal based on the means test, where I would look if the circumstances are such that someone exceeds the means test, that we could justify assisting them. It will then, once again, we'll be looking more at the affordability. But it's obviously we've got to, the concern would be as soon as you start opening it too wide in terms of our capacity availability, it becomes difficult. And then we'll have the same questions in terms of how practitioners will be surviving if we open up the legal aid system too far in terms of that gap group. Those that get legal aid and those that don't, and I think that's something that the legal profession has got to address, is how do we deal with that gap group? Those that just can't get legal aid because they're beyond our means test or in terms of affordability, but those that still can't afford a legal practitioner, I think that's something that the broader profession has got to look at as to how they address and how we deal with that. So, yes, I think, and the contribution policy, it's something we'll have to look at, but we'll have to balance it very, very carefully. On the affordability issue, affordability is specifically something that we'll look at in criminal defense cases, but how far does affordability go? And the problem for us is what we've got to evaluate is your ability to afford the cost of your legal representation, therefore what your income and the assets are, versus the duration of the trial. And the longer the duration of the trial, the more complex the trial, the less likely anyone is able to afford the cost of their legal representation. So we do look at that affordability specifically where, in terms of Section 35(3) rights are specifically then concerned, because there is what the Constitution then requires us to consider on the criminal defence side. So I don't know if that deals with the question of affordability. To just do a affordability test generally just becomes very difficult to administer, because also it can bring in an element of subjectivity as to what I regard as whether you can afford it or what somebody else does. So we get the consistency in terms of the means test, and then we allow appeal mechanisms if someone feels that that's not...
Can I modify the question?
No, wait.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't finish.
I
think... No.
The
Thanks, Jess. So that's really on the affordability, and maybe I've misunderstood the question, but I'll happily answer anything else. Then just to Mr. Sivione, in terms of your question of one-person practitioner competing, I think in terms of what is available, practitioners, one, we must understand Legal Aid South Africa has created employment opportunities that never existed prior to 2001-2002, when this legal aid system model was. And if you look at overall in terms of our employee capacity and what we've made available for legal practitioners in terms of being able to be employed by Legal Aid South Africa, 79% of our staffing are legal practitioners. So one, we've created that a great opportunity in terms of practitioners to be able to join us. Two, we do have the Judicare system. And I must say, since we've implemented the requirement in terms of tax clearance certificate, we've dropped nationally under 500 practitioners that are accredited with us with tax clearance certificates. And in fact, so much so that I think we've started trying to engage with the professions to say to us, please encourage your practitioners to submit their tax clearance certificates and accredit with us. So I think there's a great opportunity for practitioners to join. We don't have enough Judicare practitioners that are accredited and can give us tax clearance certificates. I think there's the opportunity that they should be looking at. The other issues in terms of the profession, I think we've got to look at the gap group in terms of how you grow the market also for the legal profession. But I think overall we have a constitutional mandate and responsibility to provide the representation. But we are doing it, and we do provide opportunities for practitioners specifically in private practice via Judicare, where there are conflict of interest cases where we don't want to have two practitioners in a criminal trial dealing with it. I think, Chair, those were the questions that I've dealt with. I don't know if the CEO or Chair would like to add anything.
Can we just get the qualification from Mr. Lanamacher?
Sorry, I interrupted you. Well, I wanted to just avoid you going on a tangent. The affordability that I was asking about was for Legal Aid South Africa itself, not about you assessing an applicant, to say whether there is any way of ensuring that within the guide you make provision for that, so that you don't find yourself in a situation where Legal Aid South Africa is actually expected to provide a service that it cannot afford. That was what the question was all about. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Now, here if you are asked for money, you can call the ethics hotline. Now, my question is, how successful is this practice? Please share that with us.
In terms of the issue of affordability, obviously in terms of Section 35(2) and 3 rights, that's specifically defined in terms of the Constitution, and we wouldn't be able to refuse legal aid to someone that, in terms of those rights as are defined in terms of our mandate. What we do say in the guide, though, is specifically when it comes to legal aid and in civil matters, that there has to be a progressive realization and that it is subject to the availability of resources. So specifically in terms of the guide, there is a provision in that if we're not able to afford or we don't have the resources to make it available, that we can then refuse to provide it. What we don't do is do that generally. So one justice centre may not have the capacity or the resources to assist in a specific matter, but what we then require is that the justice centres consult with the regional heads so that if we can see within a region or within overall legal aid that we can't able to fit and accommodate that case via our own system, so that we just don't say at this justice centre we don't have the capacity but we might have it another. So we've got to look overall where our capacity lies and could we assist not necessarily at the specific justice centre but at another. But there is that limitation that if we don't have the resources and we don't have the necessary funding, that it is a progressive realisation. We can't do everything.
The hotline, that's the question.
Yes,
I remember when I used to sit as a judge before I went to the SCA, I cut out a number of clients who had been made to pay by legal aid practitioners. But this hotline has helped us. Those incidents of our practitioners demanding money from our clients have waned. So that the hotline is a real threat, if I may say so. Not only in that regard, in a number of other regards.
We'll do it tomorrow and we'll argue that we took overnight to consider it. All right, we'll do it tomorrow. We'll just ensure you have a quorum, Mr. Romano, Mr. Cinnamon. Tomorrow, please make sure we have a quorum. For the suit today, for the adoption of this guide, all right?
I know that's what I'm coming.
Yes, there is that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's it. All right. Let me add my little word of congratulations to Judge Mlambo, Judge McCarthy. I recall coming to this place in 1994, and technically, accountants have this language of their own when they say, technically, you're bankrupt. Technically, legal aid, then it was legal aid board, was the thing. And they survived in the same way that SABC survives now, with annual bailouts. Yes, amongst others. And so, and of course, annually, there were these, the most awful auditor generals reports. So you had these two situations, and after about 7 years, we had come to the point as a portfolio committee where we wanted to say to the minister, Dala Omar then, just lock the doors, give the keys to the accountant general, and start again. We can't see any other way. He remembers. But fortunately, Minister Omar then had already discussed things with a few people, and we have what we have today. And I will never forget that time. We had really reached that point where we said, no, really, receiving an Auditor General's report on legal aid was like the most depressing thing you can imagine. It was terrible. A long list of matters of adverse findings. Terrible. So when the members say that you are now a shining example for other state entities, it's real. It's real. And Mr. Slot, before he left, said to me, this is not a reflection on the media, but sometimes you should write about things like the success story of legal action.
That's what I would say to
the So, we trust that other entities use your example and learn from it. And the cameraman and the interviewer from SABC said, "You mean like us, Mr. Landers?" I said, "Yes." we are encouraged by the fact that the Minister of Justice has taken, well, in principle, a decision to review the Commissions Act. And so we hope that that sort of lands before us as speedily as possible. We don't see how the current situation can go on without clarity, legal clarity, regarding the funding and you're quite correct. The authorities establishing the commission should also determine where the funds come from. But having said that, it's always a pleasure to have you before us, and long may it continue, and we thank you very much.
Chairperson.
Yes.
Just to say, I'm sorry to speak after you.
No.
Sorry. Yeah. They are also, I know Honourable Gentleman sometimes differs with me. I was always saying, when you look back, there are casualties. Attorneys who were doing work off the legal aid board then, as a result of which they ended up in trouble because a person will busy himself or herself with the instructions from the legal aid board. At the end of the day, that person, that practitioner himself, is in trouble that he can't pay overheads and the like. And some of them, there are few casualties who ended up having to tap in the trust account and the track of the law. That we must not leave out that sad story, which was influenced by the legal aid board.
Yeah,
it's a painful
one. Just account, it's a no-no.
Sorry to speak after you, but the failing in my duty as a professor not to give the cum laude. And also of the failing as a karate specialist not to say they did an ippon, Master Sruk.
Thank you.